This is NBC News. The Pentagon Papers, the public's right to know. This is Wilson Hall. The Supreme Court ruled today that the New York Times and the Washington Post are free to continue publication of articles based on secret Pentagon studies of how the U.S. got involved in the Vietnam War. The Supreme Court disagreed with the government's contention that continued publication would harm the national security. The vote, 6-3. The unsigned majority opinion declared that the government had to meet the heavy burden of showing justification for prohibiting newspapers from printing stories about the controversial documents. The ruling went on to say that district courts in New York and in Washington had held that the government had not shown justification for prior restraints. The ruling read simply, "We agree." The three dissenting votes were from Chief Justice Berger, Justices Blackmun and Harlan. All agreed that the case had been conducted with too much haste for the justices to make the necessary studies of all the conflicting arguments. The case did get from lower courts to the nation's highest court in record time of less than 2 weeks. There are other legal matters relative to today's historic decision. NBC News Supreme Court correspondent Carl Stern reports.
Despite all the legal arguments, the results seem to turn on how the justices view newspapers. Chief Justice Berger, a frequent critic of the press, accused the New York Times of dishonor and said even a cab driver would understand his duty to hand over stolen documents. On the other hand, justices who long have viewed the press with respect and admiration lined up uniformly on the other side of the case. Justice Black said the Times and the Washington Post should be commended for courageous reporting. The dissenters seemed to mix fact and law. Justice Blackmun, Mr. Nixon's other appointee, said bluntly, "The First Amendment is only part of the Constitution and should not take priority over Article II powers of the President." He ignored the fact that for 40 years the court has said the First Amendment contains basic freedoms and occupies a preferred position. Blackmun also noted over and over again that at least one judge of the nine in Washington who reviewed the Pentagon documents on the Court of Appeals found a basis for worrying about their publication. He suggested the day might come when the people could hold the Times responsible for the death of soldiers, the destruction of alliances, the inability of our diplomats to negotiate, and prolongation of the Vietnam War. That's a pretty grim picture, which was not shared by any of the other justices. The third dissenter, John Harlan, is a conservative and perhaps the best scholar on the present court. Right from the beginning in Saturday's courtroom argument, he wondered aloud whether the court should move at all into acting as a board of censors, judging what would hurt the nation's security and what would not. He said the legal handling of the case had been irresponsibly feverish. He said the court should go along with the chief executive if the matter is properly related to foreign affairs. Oddly enough, each of the nine justices seemed to end up today precisely where they stood before the argument. Today's decision disposed of the case, but only on one issue, the government's attempt to block publication. The next chapter will be the government's prosecution under the Espionage Act of Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, who admits he gave the documents to the Times. The court could go either way on that question, whether those who leaked the papers should be punished as criminals. More pieces of this case are bound to reach the court. Carl Stern, NBC News, Washington.
The Supreme Court, which normally takes months to rule on constitutional issues, decided this historic press case in record time. The hours the court's members were hearing the case, the days they were deciding and writing their decisions, were dramatic for the nine men on the nation's highest bench and for spectators and listeners. Charles Quinn reports from the Supreme Court.
The decision had been 5 days coming. The court got the case on Friday, held a rare session on Saturday. It forced Justice Douglas to fly back from his vacation retreat in the state of Washington. The court heard arguments, reserved judgment, and then the wait. At first, the decision was expected on Monday, then yesterday. Finally, this afternoon, it came. The courtroom was not quite full, 200 people or more, lawyers, tourists, newsmen. The justices are usually precisely prompt. Today, they were 5 minutes late. Douglas wasn't there. He had flown back to Washington. Justice Berger read the opinion. At first, this was seen as bad news for the newspapers. The justice who reads the majority opinion is generally a spokesman for the majority. Berger was almost certain to vote with the government, with the Nixon administration. Therefore, it seemed that the decision might go against the two newspapers. Berger kept the courtroom in suspense. He pointed out that the government carried a heavy burden in justifying its effort to prevent publication of the Pentagon Papers. He also pointed out that lower courts in New York City and Washington had held that the government had not met that burden. And without pausing, Berger added, tersely, "We agree." So that finally was the decision everyone had been waiting for. A gasp from the courtroom, Berger quickly ended his reading. The Chief Justice, of course, did not agree. He had voted with a minority. The 6-3 vote had generally been expected, with the more liberal justices siding with the press, the more conservative against. The entire session today took only a few minutes. Reporters rushed off to file their stories. There were smiles of relief from lawyers and officials of the Washington Post because the press had won. Charles Quinn, NBC News, Washington.
The New York Times, which first broke the Pentagon paper story on June 13th, will continue its series in tomorrow morning's edition. Jim Herriot was at the Times when word of the court's decision was received.
Moments after the announcement of the Supreme Court decision came, Arthur Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times, and other officials walked into an upstairs auditorium at the paper, and several Times staffers burst into applause. Sulzberger calls it a major First Amendment victory.
My reaction is obviously one of complete joy and delight. I never really doubted that this day would come and that we'd win. And sometimes it seemed like it was going to be a little longer awaiting than I had hoped, but here it is, and we're starting publishing tomorrow.
Publisher Sulzberger says there's been no discussion, no decision about the possibility of defending Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, the man who's admitted he leaked the Pentagon Papers to the Times and is facing federal charges. Sulzberger says he hopes the court's decision will help Ellsberg, as he put it, come out better for having these papers released. As to what will be published, starting with tomorrow's editions, managing editor Abe Rosenthal leaves little doubt.
There will be no changes in the presentation of the article. We will present them exactly as we'd planned. In other words, we're not going to try to rewrite leads or stick in inserts or to fool around with the copy. We spent months putting this in historical perspective, and we're going to proceed exactly on that basis.
Rosenthal told me the pages were carefully locked away in preparation for a court victory. They're all ready for the press run later this evening. What remains is the question of prior restraint. Jim Goodale, vice president and general counsel of the Times, indicates a battle's been won, but the war may be far from over.
Well, I think that the question could be brought up again, yes. There's no firm opinion, I would say, by the court today as I heard it. It's a variety of concurring opinions.
But Arthur Sulzberger thinks the government will be more cautious in the future, and New York Congressman Ogden Reed says tonight he believes prior restraint would be used only in grave situations that deal with survival of this country, not merely an embarrassment to officials here and elsewhere. Jim Herriot, NBC News, New York.
Reaction at the Washington Post. Ron Nesson was there.
Many of the reporters and most of the executives of the Washington Post milled around the newsroom as the time approached for the Supreme Court to announce its ruling. At 2:36, Eugene Patterson, the managing editor, climbed up on a desk and shouted, "We win. The Washington Post wins, and so does the New York Times." The newsmen applauded. Benjamin Bradley, the executive editor, kissed Catherine Graham, the publisher. Bradley also collected money on bets he won on the decision from other newsmen. At first, the wire service stories did not give details of the ruling, and Bradley kept asking, "Can we print everything?" Finally, assured that the Post was free to resume publication of its articles based on the Pentagon documents, Bradley said, "Let's go to work." The paper's editorial officials crowded into an office and began planning tomorrow morning's edition. The Post has 6 articles based on the Pentagon documents already written and a 7th almost finished. Tomorrow morning's paper will carry 3 of the articles. It also will carry in full the 9 separate opinions of the Supreme Court justices. Once tomorrow's paper was in the works, Post officials took time out to comment on the ruling. The publisher, Mrs. Graham, said she thought it was a victory for good government and the public's right to know, and not just a victory for her newspaper. She said she expects the decision to open up the whole question of classification of government documents. The executive editor, Bradley, said the paper never intended to embarrass government officials who took part in the Vietnam decisions. Rather, he said, the paper only wanted to print what it considered information the American people have a right to know.
We are free to publish what we always were going to publish, which was material which, in our mind, the public had a right to know and which did no damage to the United States. That was our position when we started printing, and it's our position today.
One footnote, the Washington Post, which has crusaded long and eloquently for freedom of the press,
banned another news medium, television film cameras, from its newsroom when the decision was announced. Ron Nesson, NBC News, Washington.
Other newspapers followed the Times and the Post in printing stories based on the Pentagon study. Only two, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Boston Globe, were restrained by lower courts from printing further stories. Their cases did not reach the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court decision in favor of publication means that they, too, will continue their articles. Many members of Congress of both parties were privately and some publicly furious when the excerpts from the Pentagon Papers were published. Not so much at the publication, but that they had not known what was going on between the Defense Department and the White House, that they had asked for the reports and had been denied access to them. That feeling will not be dampened by the Supreme Court decision. Robert McCormick reports from Capitol Hill.
Any political seismologist could have predicted the congressional eruption over what the House and Senate, especially the Senate, consider the promiscuous use of secrecy to keep the public from knowing anything the executive branch of the government doesn't want it to know. Senator Gravel's emotional, unorthodox explosion about the Pentagon Papers was only the beginning of what could happen. Formal action by the Senate to punish the Alaska Democrat seems unlikely. As Republican Aiken of Vermont said, it would seem a little fruitless in view of the Supreme Court's decision. The most open fight over secrecy has by tradition been between the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on one side and the State and Defense Departments on the other. The Foreign Relations Committee has had its very own documents gathered by its very own investigators classified as secret. But the Armed Services Committee has also had problems. Its staff has put together pieces of information that were public knowledge in the localities where they originated, as, for example, Army camps. But once it was collected, it was firmly stamped secret. And in some cases, chairmen and members of committees couldn't see documents and testimony presented to their own committees. The file cabinets were decorated with the bright red cardboard secret signs and locked. On top of all this, committees couldn't get on any basis information to which they thought they were entitled. In a general sense, even the angriest senators and representatives have been reluctant to make public classified information on their own hook because they're afraid the executive branch will punish them by giving them even less information, using the argument that Congress can't keep a secret anyhow. Not all members of Congress have been resentful, that goes without saying, but an increasing number have been seething and getting closer and closer to blowing up, and it was in that setting that the ruckus broke over the Pentagon Papers. Robert McCormick, NBC News at the Capitol.
The man who gave the New York Times the Pentagon Papers is Dr. Daniel Ellsberg. He admitted he was the man who did it. He had access to them when he was working for the Defense Department. He was in Vietnam, where, as he tells it, he began to have doubts about the U.S. involvement and the tragedies it was causing the Vietnamese people. Ellsberg has been indicted for having secret documents in his possession and for not returning them to the Defense Department. After surrendering to a federal judge in Boston, Ellsberg met reporters.
We were informed by the judge that the charge against us, against me, involves a possible 10-year sentence. I wonder if there are many people here who wouldn't think that 10 years in prison was very cheap if they could contribute to ending this war.
Dr. Ellsberg continued his talk with reporters in a philosophic vein.
There's a time for acting, there's a time for reading and learning, and I think you take them one at a time. The time right now, I think, what's called for is reading these papers that the newspapers are making available to the public. I hope the Congress will make them available to the public in their entirety. I certainly sympathize with those who say that even what we've seen so far is not enough, that individual documents, that snatches, that one person's interpretation are not what the public needs. I think the least they need is that entire report, every word of it, certainly every word that the Supreme Court determines can be made available, should be made available, and I'm hoping to see that.
Last Monday, the Foreign Policy Association in New York listened to an exchange of viewpoints on what impact the publications of the papers had and would have. Senator Birch Bayh, Democrat from Indiana, was the first speaker. Here are excerpts from what he said.
The impact of these papers, I think, has been a source of some significant embarrassment to the country. My thoughts are that I have not seen any thing in those that have been presently released that contain some of the traditional nuclear secrets, the type of thing that we normally equate to national security. If I were to have made the decision early on, if you could have said, well, do you want these released or not, to the man who first released them, I would say, let's not release them, because I think there has been some significant embarrassment. But once you start releasing something like this, you can only compound the embarrassment by trying to hide it. And I think the American people and us, our nation as a whole, is strong enough to accept the truth as it is, to try to profit from the mistakes that have been made therein so that we don't make them again. I do have one concern. I say this as a legislator with not as much sympathy as I could if I were in the executive branch. Pardon me, let me say that as if I had been in the executive branch. I think there is something to be said, for that's part of the argument, that talks in terms of a frank relationship between a citizen of this country, an expert, a White House staffer, but particularly a non-White House staffer that is called into play because of his expertise in the private sector to give a frank discussion of a given situation. That this frankness plus equally frank relationships with other governments, I think, can be jeopardized by the disclosure of this type of documentary. I would like to make a distinction between that type of embarrassment and the embarrassment that tends to say that a public official was wrong. I see no reason not to disclose fully papers if the only reason is to keep a public official of my party or another party from being embarrassed. I am concerned about our relationships with other governments.
Following Senator Bayh was Professor Walter Rostow. Rostow worked for the State Department, was a special advisor to President Johnson.
The only part of Senator Bayh's comment, which I'd strongly disagree, is the notion that these Pentagon papers, especially as they've been presented, represent the truth or even an approximation of the truth. There are three systematic distortions in what we read, at least in the New York Times. The first was the distortion of the papers themselves. They are a limited collection of documents. There is nothing in them that reflects the discussions of the president with his advisors or the extremely important discussions of the president with the congressional leadership. Second, some, not all, of the 36 authors felt free on the basis of this limited evidence to draw conclusions about what was in the president's mind and the considerations bearing upon his decisions. Some of these reflections from anonymous authors on imperfect evidence were used by the New York Times as evidence on which conclusions could be based. But far and away, the greatest distortion was the gap between the conclusions as presented by the New York Times headline writers, lead writers, editorial writers, and commentators. The distortions between the evidence, even that evidence actually published, and what was said. Now, as I've said on another occasion, that if any student of mine at the University of Texas should have done a term paper in which there was a gap between the evidence and the conclusions as wide as that in the New York Times, he would be flunked and he would expect to be flunked. The simple truth of the matter is, and incidentally, I speak now as someone who knows the evidence, but I speak with perhaps more fervor than I would if I were directly involved, because I was then in the State Department and not at the heart of the White House. The simple truth of the matter is that President Johnson did not lie, he did not deceive the people, and if you want to check it for yourself, do what I did the other day. Get the files of the New York Times out and read them for this period. There is not the slightest nuance in the decision-making process that wasn't quite accurately reflected in the press and the media of that time. That what is portrayed as secret decisions to take action sometime in the future were normal contingency planning that it would have been irresponsible for any government not to take.
Following Senator Bayh was Professor Walter Rostow. The case of the government versus the New York Times and the Washington Post had ramifications other than the First Amendment and the freedom of the press. What about classification of documents? Who should classify them and why? Since the Pentagon paper case broke, we've heard many persons criticize how documents are classified. One former military man and later a civilian Defense Department official familiar with security said flatly that 99.5% of government documents which carry a classification stamp were no danger at all to national security. Others who are working or have worked in government pointed out that far too many low echelon workers routinely stamp top secret on their reports to make sure their superiors read their efforts. Surely something must be done to make reasonable rules and regulations governing what documents should be classified, which leads to something having to be done to declassify documents. Who decides when the nation's security is not germane to some piece of paper that has been stamped secret or top secret? Surely something must be done to declassify documents which are not directly affecting the nation's security. Another point that has often been made, shouldn't Congress, which is elected by the people, have as much to say about policies that could lead to the life or death of a nation, certainly people, as the men around the president who have no political base, those men around the president who are answerable only to the president? Today, the Supreme Court decided, 6-3, that newspapers could publish the Pentagon Papers without prior restraint. The Supreme Court decision will not still the many debates that the publication of the papers have started. Wilson Hall, NBC News.